welcome to episode 132 of Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
And today we are not doing a comparison of two books. We are talking about just one book, Edith Holler, by the novelist and playwright Edward Carey. I believe this is his eighth novel, started in the year 2000 with Observatory Mansions. And again, so thrilled to say this, but we actually have Edward Carey with us on the call. Hello, Edward.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Wonderful to be here.
We're so happy to have you. Long-term listeners of Tea or Books will know back in episode 67, we talked about your novels Little and Alva and Irva, and both loved those. So we were very excited when we had the chance to have you on the episode. So of course we will get on to talking about you and your career and this wonderful novel, but we'll start with what we're currently reading or have just read. Rachel, why do we start with you?
The book I've just read is obviously Edith Holler, but before, which we'll talk about in much more detail in a minute, I finished this week the new Elizabeth Strout novel, the name of which has gone completely out of my head. I've just got Edward Carey in my head. I'm turning around to the Tell Me Everything is what it's called, and it's wonderful. It's like a combination of several of her of characters from several of her novels, and I don't know, I think it might be her best yet. So I absolutely love that. And just today I've picked up the new Olga Tokarczuk novel, which has been translated into English, which is a take on the Magic Mountain, and it's called it's set in a TB sanatorium, and it's called a horror story. So I'm intrigued to find out what's going to happen, so I'm really looking forward to starting that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. Well, two of your favourite authors, so exciting time to be you.
I know, isn't it?
Edward, what are you reading? What have you read recently?
Well, I've just come back from England, so I was, you know, poring over the shelves in bookshops and grabbing. I mean, my suitcase coming back was very, very heavy. And I picked up, you know, just some of the books that aren't here yet or maybe won't even come to America. So I'm speaking from Austin, Texas, as you said. I picked up this book about childhood literature called, I think it's called Haunted Woods by Sam Leith. And it's just about the importance of childhood reading and a sort of passion for childhood books. And it's actually absolutely thrilling, and it beautifully makes a case. I mean, I'm only about 100 pages in, and it's like 500 pages long or something, but it makes a case of absolutely how essential it is for a young reader to have this connection with literature and imagination, and it's absolutely thrilling.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I've not heard of that, but I will definitely be writing that down to look up later, possibly in the very same bookshop where you bought it.
Yes, exactly. And I've also just picked up yesterday, I was in a bookshop. I mean, I've just been in bookshops for the past week in England, but of course you can't ever not be in a bookshop. And I picked up a tiny book published by New Directions. They always have such extraordinary books. And it's called Way Far Away by Evelio Rosero, who's a Colombian novelist. I hadn't heard of him. And I've started reading it. And it's one of the most disturbing and exciting books I've ever read. I mean, it's like 90 pages long, and it's full of a very confused man in a horrible hotel with a lot of deceased mice.
I mean, that does sound like something I would expect from an Edward Carey novel, so I can see why it might appeal. Gosh, I guess the word disturbing normally puts me off a novel, but after that, the premise does sound intriguing.
It's great so far, anyway.
I've recently been reading Jhumpa Lahiri's debut collection of short stories called Interpreter of Melodies, which is my first Jhumpa Lahiri book, and I was completely blown away by how wonderful her writing is. So these short stories that are all about people either in India or in the Indian diaspora, mostly in America, and they're just sort of looks at different sorts of relationships, I guess. So some of them about marriage, some of them about a housemaid and her employer, or it might be, I've gone completely blank on any other relationships in there, but they're not all romantic relationships. But she's just so good at the misunderstandings between people and what people are not communicating properly, and sort of discontent that isn't seismic but does undermine a relationship. My favorite, I think, story in the collection was one about a couple who moved to I think it's Connecticut, and they are not Christian, but the people who previously owned the house are Christian, and they start finding all these religious relics around the house, sort of hidden in drawers or behind the curtain or something. And the wife gets obsessed with these and thinks they're wonderful, and the husband just doesn't understand why she's interested in them, because she's not looking to convert, she's just somehow overwhelmed by them. And the fact that, yeah, they have such a different view on it, and it really bothers him and it doesn't bother her, is just done so beautifully. So yeah, I'll certainly be reading more by her. I'm really glad that I finally, I mean, years ago I did own one of her collections of short stories and gave it away unread, which I'm now kicking myself for. Have either of you read Jhumpa Lahiri?
Yes, and that collection I absolutely adore. And the title story I often teach, creative writing here, and we go through the Interpreter of Maladies, and it's amazing seeing the students react to it.
Brilliant. Rachel?
Yeah, I've read most of her stuff, actually. I think her novels are brilliant. The Lowland was one on the Booker Prize list a few years ago. I remember reading that with my students. I'm a teacher as well, but not university, secondary school. And I thought that was wonderful. And then I think The Namesake is brilliant as well. So, yeah, she's an incredible novelist.
Yeah, I'm late to the party, but I have the enthusiast of the convert, so I will certainly be reading more. Lots of recommendations there. Sounds like we're all having good reading weeks. Hello, it's Simon jumping on before we get to the main interview. Just to say, you will have heard us talk about going to the Marlborough Literary Festival in the previous couple of episodes, where Rachel interviewed me about the British Library Women Writers series, which is a wonderful day. Thank you so much for those who were able to make it. But if you weren't able to make it and you support our Patreon at patreon.com/teaorbooks, then as a thank you for all your support, we've uploaded the I guess recording there. Yeah, we just had my phone on the table, so the sound quality is not amazing, but maybe it'll make you feel a bit like you were in the room if you weren't able to be there. So that's for people who support the Patreon, which you can do from, I think, as little as £2. I'm so grateful to those who do. It really helps, you know, buy the mic, do the editing, all those sorts of things. And just as a thank you, wanted to share that recording. It was a really fun conversation. If you do support the Patreon, or you sign up and you can't find it, then message me and I will help you find it, because it's not necessarily the most obvious if you're new to it. And now back to Rachel, Edward and me. Edward, we'll come to you. In fact, speaking of sort of childhood reading and the importance of reading, I thought it'd be interesting if we start maybe with different books that have been important to you at different times. Were there particular books that particularly influenced you as you were a child or a teenager, as you sort of formed your view of the world?
Yeah, I have to say that I was given by a teacher, and I must have been maybe 8 or 9 or 10, which is rather a large number of years, but let's settle on 9. I was given Alan Garner's The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, and it had such a profound effect on me. It was the first time I read a book where I felt I was actually in it, and it became sort of private, and that I was caught up with it, and I only ever wanted to be in that world. And it was that, you know, that particular magic that we get when we have a really close reading of a book, and it's set in a real place, Alderley Edge in Cheshire. I've never been there, and yet I feel I know it intimately. And there's something about the power of all Garner's writings. His masterpiece, I think, is the Owl Service. But all of it is absolutely extraordinary. And I think my relationship with that book at that young age felt so special. So it felt so necessary. It felt so exciting. It felt like it opened the possibilities of all sorts of different things to me, that you could look at a landscape and find stories and magic and mystery in it. It had an absolutely, you know, profound effect. There were other writers like Susan Cooper and Diana Wynne Jones that meant a great deal to me. Watership Down as well, but you know, as a child, those, you know, the books would just, it was suddenly that business of, and I do think it is magic. It is absolute magic. I don't think there's another word for it, where you pick up a book and you're transported, and to have that as a, you know, young age, falling in love with stories is just, is so essential. You know, we often hear about the arts not, you know, being a luxury. Well, absolute nonsense. I mean, you know, the necessity of the arts. You know, a child without any imagination is, you know, or without any access to it, I mean, is an abused individual.
Yes, wonderfully put. Yes. I was once at a book launch for one of Alan Garner's books, and I felt very I was receiving a privilege I shouldn't have received, since I've never read him, but I was there in his presence and still haven't. Well,
And he's got a new book out. I think it came out in England on Thursday. I flew back on Thursday morning. I couldn't get hold of it, which made me mad, because it won't come out here until, you know, much later or at all. I'll have to pick it up later. But I love the fact that he keeps writing his last book. So he's on his, you know, maybe fifth or sixth last book by now, and may there be many, many more last books.
Yes, he's not a young man, is he?
He's not, bless him, but a very important one.
Still, I mean, going.
Those amazing, you know, writers. Susan Cooper's still alive. I just think, oh my God, you know, reading The Dark is Rising and Oversea and Understone, you know, that whole sequence is just, you know, those books, astounding. What a gift. Or, you know, what a gift, I Capture the Castle is to young people. Just astounding.
Yes, I met Susan Cooper at the Bodleian as well, actually. It was a good place to hang around for these things. And I've also not read anything by her. So, but I did have a very starstruck colleague there who was sort of approaching her, and you could see in the approach that she was holding the weight of all her childhood expectations in those few words of just saying, "Susan, I love your books." But,
I was in a secondhand bookshop in Norwich a few days ago, and there was the childhood copy I had of The Dark is Rising, with a very disturbing cover. And it was just like, oh my God, here I am. And suddenly I was a child again. And of course I picked it up for the paltry £2 asking price. You know, but this should have been hundreds of pounds. What are you talking about?
Absolutely. let's jump forward a little while to your... Yeah, how did you first get published? I know Observatory Mansions was your first published novel. Was it also the first novel you wrote?
I did write another novel, but rather half-heartedly, it must be admitted. And I just thought, well, you can dash it off and everybody will publish it. It would be marvellous. And I had a wonderful... mentor playwright called Hugh Whitemore, who was very generous but also quite stern, and would tell you, I mean mercifully, would tell you exactly what he felt and things. And he did look at my first novel, which was about an altarpiece in the National Gallery in London. It's a big altarpiece by Carlo Crivelli coming to life and whisking around London, which is possibly a premise for a novel. I have no idea, but you told me no. and it was very good advice, actually, and I wasn't hurt by it. I thought, yeah, you know, I could have dashed it off, you know, what the hell are you thinking about? And then I worked as a playwright for a long time, and that was what I wanted to do. But when I was at university, I was in Bradford, the one and only time I've ever been in Bradford, and I went to a bookshop, and I never usually, then I didn't go to bookshops, now I'm never out of them, but I was in a bookshop, and there was a copy of Günter Grass's The Tin Drum there, and I picked it up. I was fascinated by the image on the cover that Grass himself had drawn. And I just started reading the first chapter, and the first-person voice of The Tin Drum by Oscar Matsarath, decliner Oscar, who refuses to grow, remains child size. He throws himself down the stairs because he thinks adults are such morons, and decides from this tumble that he doesn't grow. And so he's a sort of permanent child, and it's kind of like a terrifying version of, say, something like Peter Pan. And I read it, and the voice was so exciting that I thought, oh my God, you can do this. And then I think, you know, we're often reading for a sense of permission. You know, there's that wonderful story of Marquez reading Kafka's Metamorphosis for the first time, and him going, "Oh my God, I didn't realize you could do that." and reading Grass, and then I bought the novel, and I was completely skint at the time. And so I thought, well, there we go. There's a couple of meals there, but and it was so astounding that it sort of held its glare, because that's what it is. It's a sort of massive high beam of a book. And then it was, you know, kind of after working as a playwright for years, I sat down and I thought I would write a novel now and actually do it seriously. And I sat in the French countryside because a friend had given me this flat. He was a chef and said, hey, do you want this flat for the summer? I'm going to be in Paris. So I went, yes. And I'd sort of run out of playwriting commissions. And I sat down and wrote my first book, you know, kind of sort of trance. I was there for three months, and I think all I did was write and smoke. I don't smoke anymore, but I smoked a lot then. In fact, I felt like I was punctuating every sentence with a cigarette, with stubbing the cigarette would be the full stop. And I looked very green and quite astoundingly unhealthy, I think. But I had this sort of sense of bliss with the novel, because I didn't really care if it worked or not. I was doing this for now, for it, and I became kind of very obsessed with it. And then I wrote a draft and then wrote another draft and sent it out to agents, and they all said no thanks. What the hell are you thinking? And then finally there was one agent who called me in for a really bad cup of coffee and said, you know, let me know when you've written something else, because there's something here. But you know, when you've written your next one, you know, I thought, do you know how many cigarettes it took me to write this novel? And out of it, I got a bad cup of coffee. And then finally, my current agent, my one and only agent, who I'm still with, took it on. And then the guy with the bad coffee immediately said, no, I'll take you on. I'll take you on. And I said, no, you won't, mate. I'm going with a woman who has much better coffee. And is much nicer and wanted me straight away. And anyway, she sent it out and Picador picked it up in the UK. And so it began.
Wonderful. And yes, a few times over my different book clubs and things, I've been in discussions of books featuring unusual jobs. And I always think of the Living Statue career in Observatory Mansions. Mentioned that. I'm sure we'll mention other of your books, but we should get on to the main one, Edith Holler, that we'll be talking about today. And Rachel, maybe I'll hand to you. Perhaps, I'm sure Ed was tired of summarising it or giving the elevator pitch for it. So Rachel, if you could introduce us to the book and then start some questions.
The pressure.
Edward can do a buzzer if you get anything wrong.
So the premise of this book, the protagonist is a girl called Edith Holler. She is a playwright and she lives in the Theatre Royal in Norwich, but known as the Holler Theatre for her. And her whole family has for generations has been a kind of theatre impresarios and has been connected with this theatre. And she has been she was cursed on her christening day and told that if she ever left the theatre would fall down. So she can't leave the theatre and hasn't left the theatre. So at the beginning she's 12 years old and she's never left its walls, and she lives her life within it and observes everything within it. And it's all, the theatre is filled with this fantastic group of people who are called aunts and cousins and so on, but they're not all related to each other. Hangers on of the theatre who have been actors, and when they become no longer useful, they are put into different jobs around the theatre. And it's very eccentric cast of characters. And Edith wants to write a play, and she's doing that. And then the big moment that comes along to change her life is that her father decides to get married again, and the arrival of this new wife is going to bring to the fore the story that Edith has written about in the first place, which is her theory that these missing children, that there are lots of missing children all around Norwich, have been put into the beetle spread that's created by the Uttings factory. And the very woman that her father is going to marry is Margaret Utting, whose father is in charge of this factory and of the beetle spread. So her coming into the theatre is going to cause lots of problems. So yeah, that's the kind of the premise, without wanting to ruin too much of the plot.
Great, thank you.
Beautifully done.
She's very good at it. Yeah, ask away, Rachel.
Okay, so I mean, my grandfather and my entire father's side of my family for centuries are actually from Norwich. So I absolutely loved reading this because I think the sense of place was so amazing. And my best friend from university is also lives in Hethel, just outside of Norwich. So I go a lot. And I've never actually read a book set in Norwich before. So I would love you to talk a little bit about the kind of the place and space in novels and where that comes from, because everything I've read from you, you manage to create such the places where you set your novels become characters themselves, and they're so steeped in where their characters sort of belong and inhabit. It doesn't necessarily need to be a city, but it can also just be the home in which they are. So could you tell us a bit about why place and space are so prominent in for you? And also then, I know obviously you're from Norwich, tell us a bit about why you wanted to write a book now about Norwich.
I'm trying to think of the best way to attack this. I grew up in an old house in Norfolk, just outside of Norwich, and the house itself was Tudor, but the foundations of it were supposed to be a Saxon hall. And so the house had such a massive influence on me. It was just by the church, and there was supposed to be an underground passage from the house to the church that was apparently built during the English Civil War, so that you know, you could escape to sanctuary in the church. And it was also there were a handful of officers coming back from World War One who were put into convalescence there. And so the house itself sort of seemed to be many ages at once. And its influence on me, the house also was never quiet. It just moaned and groaned all the time and was endlessly in conversation with itself. And for me, so that was such a rich place to grow up. And I also remember, and it's, you know, part of this novel is that the beetles that you mentioned, the Death Watch beetles, is that the house was riddled with Death Watch beetles. They're very hard to get rid of once they're there, and we could hear them clicking when we were very quiet. And so, you know, part of my childhood, you'd keep quiet and you know, people coming to visit would go, "What the hell is that?" And you go, "Oh, it's all right. It's just a Death Watch beetle." You know, that whole idea of an insect that you only hear, you know, when you're actually watching a corpse before it's buried. You know, that's what its name comes from. Was you know, exciting. So for me, that sense of a building is a place of wonder. And, you know, you don't quite know it, and it might not stay the same. And, you know, there's something strange about it. I sort of, you know, that was such an influence to me. And writing this, I was sat in a bungalow in Austin, Texas, during the pandemic and longing to get home. You know, it was such a terrible time for all of us. And, of course, so many people died, and we were all stuck in our little homes, and we would, you know, look at the objects in our rooms, and, you know, with newfound interest, because there was nothing else to look at, and they became our sort of personal museums. And we found, you know, we looked at things again in a way that, you know, we hadn't since perhaps we first got hold of them. And I was thinking of a wonderful book called Voyage Around My Room by Xavier de Maistre, which it was written in the 1700s, I think. And he was a French officer, and he was placed under house arrest. And so he wrote a sort of guidebook to the room he was stuck in. And it's an extraordinary kind of idea of trying to travel when you can't travel. And we were all trying to travel during the pandemic somehow, mentally. And I wanted to go home. You know, Norwich is my home. I wanted to feel, you know, to go there. And I missed England so painfully. And I missed my siblings, family, etc., my mother. And I just thought, I was sort of going around our house, and there's a map of Norwich framed. And I just thought, well, maybe I could go there. Maybe I could actually travel there while all the time being stuck in Texas. Maybe that's the way I could do it. And I was thinking also, you know, the first time I went to see theatre was at the Theatre Royal in Norwich that my parents took me when I was a kid to see pantomimes. And it was like one of those moments where you go, oh my God, this is extraordinary. Look at these grown up human beings. What are they doing? And just going, wow, this is, you know, it just seemed to me like the most extraordinary thing in the world. And so I suddenly thought, I've worked in theatre a lot and I've always wanted to write a theatre novel. And I thought, well, now's the opportunity, because all the theatres in the world are dark now. Every single theatre is dark. All those wonderful spaces, that, and the stage is the room that travels. You can go anywhere with it. And it's just, you know, that incredible magical space. And I thought, yes, I want to go there. I want to be there. That has to be it. And I wanted to be set in Norwich. And I thought, you know, that's, Norwich is an extraordinary city. It's beautifully punctuated by its architecture. It has principally the cathedral, and on a mound there's a Norman keep, the Norwich Castle, which is amazing. And there's supposed to be a dead king in the mound underneath it. Oh, I thought, oh, I better have him in the novel too. But I was just thinking, you know, Norwich is such an interesting city. It's got what they call undercrofts, which is a vaulted cellar, medieval undercrofts, more there in the city of Norwich than anywhere else in the UK. And so the medieval city is absolutely still there. It's just there underfoot. And its sense of history and time and stories. And as you go around Norwich, it has, you know, on its big posters everywhere saying Norwich, City of Stories. And it is, you know, Julian of Norwich and Sir Thomas Browne. I mean, incredible, incredible people. And it's such a rich city. And as a kid going into Norwich from this village outside, it was like the best thing in the world. Oh, my God, we're going into Norwich today. Oh, my heavens. And you know, there's this major street called London Street. And I thought when people were talking about London, they really meant London Street in Norwich. But, you know, that was what they were talking about. And I thought, yeah, it is impressive, London Street. It really is. So I wanted to, you know, try and do that and have that sense of, you know, that sense of connection to it. But Edith, as Rachel said, she's cursed. She can't leave the theatre. And her father has her mute when the audience is in the theatre walking. He doesn't allow her to speak to the public. He silences her and uses her as a way of attracting more people into the theatre as a sort of mysterious creature. And I thought, well, maybe she becomes an expert in Norwich because people keep bringing her books of it. And she could go up onto the theatre's roof and look across at the city. And I thought, here we go, there's a novel there. And so I started doing it, but it was specifically about, for me, the flint of it was also all the theatres were closed, yes, but also the Conservative government were closing down theatres permanently. And they were saying things like, you know, ballet dancers might consider retraining and going into IT, you know. And I just think, what are you talking about? You know, as if the arts were a luxury. No, they're an absolute necessity. And I wanted, you know, it's also, I hope, a book about how older generations just destroy the chances of a younger generation. And this is about Edith trying to find her voice.
Brilliant. Yeah, I was thinking, actually, it ties into what you've just said. I was trying to think of some sort of through line through your books. And I kept thinking there were lots of people who are trapped in some way. So, you know, there's an agoraphobic in Alvra and Irva. There's this sort of semi-abandoned block of flats on a roundabout in Deputy Mansions. There's someone literally inside a big fish. And obviously, Edith is, as the novel starts, she's been trapped in this theatre her whole life. Is there something about entrapment that particularly intrigues you?
Well, they're stuck then, you know, and they need to get out. So there you go. You've got a plot.
Well, there is that. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, that sense, it's also, you know, so much of them, they're looking for a sense of identity, and they're looking for, they're looking to be acknowledged somehow, or they're, you know, that space is, you know, I hope that in many of my books, the buildings themselves are characters. And I do, you know, you see buildings, which, of course, they are characters. And so I think, you know, that journey, you know, so many of them are a journey of characters finding their voice, of standing up to people, but hopefully in, you know, different sorts of ways. In the book you mentioned, about Geppetto being swallowed in this enormous shark for 2 years. You know, I was commissioned to do an exhibit of art. I always illustrate all the books that I write, and the Parco di Pinocchio, you know, Pinocchio Park in Collodi, Carlo Collodi named himself after this small town, commissioned me to do an exhibit on Pinocchio, and I went, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, absolutely, in this extraordinary, interesting theme park to this, you know, beloved Italian character. And as I reread it, and I just thought, oh my God, you know, yes, you know, Carlo Collodi leaves Geppetto inside the belly of an enormous shark for 2 years. You know, just leaves him there. Oh, I don't need you now, Geppetto, just shut up for a long time. I'll come back to you in due course, but go away right now. And we follow on the puppet instead. But I thought, well, what's he do for that 2 years? And of course, he's an artist, and he's, you know, he would make art. His most famous piece of art is his son. And so I thought I would make for that exhibit the art that he made while he was inside the shark, out of, you know, the bones or whatever else, you know, the shark swallowed, that he could make use of it. And so actually when you're trapped in terms of, particularly in terms of the Geppetto in that novel, you actually have to kind of answer the question, who are you? And this is what he does over the course of the book, of that book.
Brilliant.
Rachel? I'm interested in, I mean, you were a playwright before you were a novelist. And I write plays myself. I'm a drama teacher. And I would love to know how you feel that kind of training as a dramatist and focusing on perhaps that more visual way of thinking about writing has impacted your novel writing?
Yeah, enormously. There's no doubt about it. And I, you know, that being involved in theatre was just essential for me as a human being, as a way of communicating. And recently here, Zadie Smith came and did a talk, and she was reading from her novel, The Fraud. And it was an amazing, she gave this extraordinary dramatic reading, and it was quite wonderful. And she talked about the sense of, you know, acting when you're writing and, you know, you're actually performing. And I thought, yeah, this seems to absolutely ring true to me. And I think I'll never lose that sense of, you know, what's a performance? It's so exciting, you know, and that sense of theatre, the curtain goes up and there you are, you're stuck. You can't go anywhere else. You can't, oh, go check my email. No, you're not, well, some people do, but you're not supposed to. And you're just stuck until the show's finished and you're stuck in that story. And it's so pure to actually cut out the rest of the world and be there to see something going forward. And I think there's something so magical when you get a piece of theatre that's wonderful. There's actually nothing better in the world, and it's so thrilling. And to lose it, you know, to think of it as something that could be thrown away is just terrible. But I always, you know, when I was writing this novel, I knew right from the beginning that Edith would be obsessed with Shakespeare. Of course, they put Shakespeare on all the time, and I adore Shakespeare, and that the novel would have a five-act structure, like Shakespearean tragedy, and we'd head towards it, and the final at the fifth act is basically her play going on stage in real time, and, you know, sometimes it's working out and sometimes it's not. But that sense of theatre, you know, never left me. And I think actually, you know, to date, all my novels have been first person. And so it's like a monologue. It's, you know, you're standing on stage and you go, here we go, here's my voice. You become that person. And I love the word we have for you know, writing first person. We can, you know, call it ventriloquism, and actually, you know, becoming someone else. And I'm a terrible ham. I'm a completely frustrated actor, and I always, you know, put on the voices. I try to become that other character as I'm doing it. That sense of performance, of being other people, of putting on other clothes, etc., etc., is really important. And so that sense of the visual, as you mentioned, is so important to me. I'm always drawing my characters. If I can't see them, I feel I don't know them. And so, you know, this is essentially, and for this one, in terms of, you know, specifically in terms of theatre, I knew that I wanted to illustrate it with a Victorian toy theatre, you know, those theatres that you would kind of cut out, and they're slightly old fashioned now, those toys, but they're so beautiful that you could actually, so the, theoretically you could cut the novel up and assemble, you know, a toy theatre. You've got the stage, you've got, you know, the stage floor, you've got the proscenium arch, you've got the back wall, you know, glue it all together, or you could just go to my website and just download it for free. But that idea that you could construct it, and that sense of play that children would have had with those sort of toys, that seemed to me, yeah, you can put on your own play, your own production, and, you know, you can have tragedies not just in flesh, but in paper and cardboard too. Oh no, this figure's fallen down flat, you know, and you go, oh no, this is terrible, he's dead, and it's just a piece of paper, but you can believe it. And so that sense of imagination, but that's something of, there's nothing, you know, so exciting, more exciting than a sitting down and watching a piece of, you know, amazing theatre. And I was in London last week, and a friend of mine was in, is in the National Theatre production of Coriolanus, and actually being able to sit and watch, you know, this pal of mine I've known since I was, you know, in my teens, now in his mid-50s on the Olivier stage, you know, that was, wow, you know, that's so exciting. But I also, you know, I worked in theatre for a long time, and I also worked, you know, with a shadow puppet master in Malaysia, and that was extraordinary. And seeing him, you know, these puppets are flat, of course, and they're made of skin, you know, taut skin. And there were some of the comic characters from these plays had this sort of sacred life to them. And when he moved them, they felt so alive. I had no understanding that something that's basically two-dimensional could have such life. And they were so important in the village that he worked that when people got sick, they would ask for him to come to their sick beds with those puppets, and he would put the puppet over the ill person in bed, and they would feel comforted. And I think that power of theatre is something, you know, extraordinary and amazing. And I was so lucky that, you know, I had terrible jobs when I left university. Best thing in the world to have terrible jobs. you know, I worked for Madame Tussauds. That was a great terrible job. And I also was a stage door keeper of a West End theatre. And so I had the keys to the theatre myself. I was the first person in that theatre. And I unlocked it. It's a comedy theatre on Panton Street. Now the Harold Pinter Theatre. David Tennant's doing his Macbeth there right now. And I would unlock that theatre. Nobody else was there. It was mine, all mine. I unlocked the theatre, turned the alarm off, and I could go and walk on the stage and go, here I am. And the sense of wonder of that place. And then in the middle of the day and towards the end of it, there were lots of other people there in my theatre. and it was outrageous. But then, thankfully, at the end of the day, the theatre would be returned to me again. And actually, the noise of an empty theatre, the whole moor of the auditorium without anybody in it, and people pouring out of pubs in London, and the sounds being distorted inside the theatre was terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. And then I would lock the theatre up and bike off home again. But that was an amazing gift, having that close relationship with the building. Back we are to buildings again.
Mm. You've mentioned it there. I was going to ask about the role of illustrations in your books, sort of maybe part of the creative role of them as you're writing the book. It sounds like you draw as you're writing. What role do they play? And have publishers always been happy to include them?
No. So in my first novel, Observatory Mansions, which Piccolo published in the UK, and then different editions elsewhere. Some I did eight etchings for them, the character sort of studies, and Piccolo eventually said, "Yeah, all right, you can have them in." And they're so badly reproduced. I mean, thank you, Piccolo. Very grateful. Exactly. But could you do better on that? And the illustration was so badly reproduced. And from that, you know, it sort of carried on. I kept saying, can I do my own cover? And they would go, oh, do shut up. you know, would be basically be the response. But slowly over time, now it's now I think every publisher lets me do my own cover and lets me have the illustration. For me, it's an essential part. I need to have the dialogue between text and art. That's an important tension for me, as they, you know, sometimes the illustrations might slightly contradict the text or seem, you know, different to explain something else. That, for example, in my novel Little, which is about Madame Tussaud, it's illustrated throughout with pencil drawings, but those pencil drawings are, I say, by Madame Tussaud, that she's drawing them as she goes on. But it's a humble thing, you know, the pencil. It's all she could get, you know, all she could get hold of, and she's using the pencil to actually still, you know, be alive, to have, you know, have individuality, to have her opinions, and each line of graphite is her saying here I am in the world. And so for different things, for the Madame Tussaud book, I carved a fully articulated wooden woman of Madame Tussaud, this wooden doll. Yeah. It's like 4 foot something tall, moves arms and legs, etc. She's got glass eyes. My wife was very kind and had a haircut so that this doll could have some hair. And she sits at home with us. You know, that doll is in the book, and I felt like I needed to have it. And Madame Tussaud was tiny, and she's the proper height of, the exact height of Madame Tussaud. And so I felt I needed to do that. But also for that book, I made a wax death mask of one of the characters, because I needed to understand the process of making wax. Of course, she's famous for her wax figures. But so different things in Alvernerva. You mentioned I made a, you know, sculpture of the whole city the novel set in. And so, you know, for each book, I want to do something slightly different, to find a different way of using art. And for the Geppetto, so the Swallowed Man book, I managed to get hold of, you know, some bones, big bones, that I thought the shark might have swallowed, and I, you know, one of them, just for example, I there was a huge flat bone that came from a whale, and I could paint a skyscape on it, and I called it Joseph's window, Giuseppe's window, Geppetto, and because he can't see out, there's nowhere to see out, but he paints this skyscape as if it's a window, and he looks at it as if he could see, you know, he could see the sky outside. And also in that same one, I thought, well, how can he paint? There's no paintbrushes around. And so I thought, well, he hasn't shaved since he got in the shark. He would use his beard hair. And so I made brushes out of beard hair, and I can't, you know, I'm still clean shaven at the age of 54. You know, I can't grow a beard. So I went to a very hirsute friend and said, may I? It feels like I'm going around everybody stealing their hair. But so I, you know, cut off some, you know, made some, you know, beard paintbrushes. And so, you know, so each book needs to be different. And with Edith Holler, I thought, yes, I can make that toy theater. And actually, the first illustration I did, right when the idea of the novel was in its infancy, was just a single figure of, you know, toy theater figure to be cut out by a child of Edith herself in a sort of gray smock with her hands down and her mouth open, basically saying, here I am. And then I thought, yeah, we're off. This is it. This will be that book.
Wow. And how soon did Edith come to you in the process of thinking of this book? Was she the first thing, or was the kind of the wider plot first, and then you kind of settled on her? What was your process?
Well, I think, you know, I knew it would be theatre. I knew it would be Norwich. And then I thought, when in Norwich? I haven't said it now. I don't know Norwich now. I only know Norwich when I was there. But I didn't want to set it in the, you know, 1970s, you know, with you know, the first craze of Star Wars or something. No, I wanted to, that didn't feel right. And I thought, actually, I was thinking of bloody Brexit and, you know, what that has done to the country. And I thought, is there another way of looking at Britain, well, at England specifically, which would, you know, somehow lean into that. And I thought, oh yes, the death of Queen Victoria. 1901, that time when actually, you know, she'd been queen for so long that people would have felt, oh my God, who are we now? And this was before Elizabeth II had died, but obviously she wasn't going to last forever. And so I thought that would be it. And also, you know, doing research into Norwich, that Norwich back then made much of the funeral crepe for the whole country. So their business was mourning. And so I wanted to cover the theatre, you know, with mourning black, and everybody would have armbands, you know, and this whole thing, the country in widow's weeds. And then I just thought, oh, this is something, something's happening. And then I thought that also in Norwich, I remember being told as a child about this ghost called the Grey Lady. Now, I know everybody has, every city, town, village has a Grey Lady. They're everywhere. These Grey Ladies, you can't escape them. But there's one in Tombland, which is a part of Norwich, which sounds, oh my God, it's called Tombland. Well, it's from a Scandinavian word meaning empty space, but it's a wonderful, there are plenty of tombs in Tombland, but that's not why it's named. But anyway, there during the plague in Norwich, there was a young woman who'd been shut up inside a plague house. All her family had died of the plague, but she was still alive and they didn't know. They only found out afterwards because she had eaten some of her family and then died. And she's supposed to haunt Tombland, this small, they say a grey lady, but she's a grey child. And I was thinking she became the sort of Flint, we meet her, this character, later on in the novel. But she was one of the inspirations into Edith herself. And so I began to think also at that time, and you know, living in America where a child's life is cheap, you know, if you're a gun you'll have all sorts of rights, but if you're a child or a woman you'll have no rights at all. And I was thinking, I want to represent these people who are pushed down. And so I wanted it to be a young female voice, and I wanted her to gradually find her voice as the novel process. So I knew it was going to be her. And I thought, well, what does she sound like? And I thought, rather a raspy voice, because she can't use it in public. But also that she would be in that time of, you know, the pandemic that we went through. I wanted her to be filled with fancy, that she, right from her earliest childhood, she's never left the theatre, as Rachel said. And she'd just been spoon-fed stories, as if they were sustenance. And so what would that be like, this creature just made up of fancy? And so then I thought, come on, open your mouth, Edith, let's see what comes out.
Amazing. I wanted to ask about genre. I was thinking, if you saw a sort of just a list of what happens in the book without the writing tone or without getting to know the characters, you know, things like this entrapment in the theatre, or even things down to the detail of like the profusion of beetles coming out of a stuffed body, you could think this was fairy tale, you could think this was farce, you could think this was historical fiction at a push, or horror. And for my money, I think this feels the closest to horror of the books I've read by you. But I was wondering, is particular genre or genre trope something that you're thinking about when you're writing, or are you just thinking about character and incident, and then the sort of genre looks after itself?
Yeah, I think I'm, you know, just focusing on the story itself. I don't actively kind of go out for, right, I'm going to write a horror book, or I'm going to, you know, what seems true, what seems right for that particular book. But, you know, one thing I'll never be able to write is, you know, realistic fiction. I can't do it. And I've also absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. You know, that, I mean, I read it, you know, but I can't do it myself. It's like if I tried to draw like a realistic, you know, nice face, it would turn grotesque within seconds. So I don't have any choice. But I think, you know, sometimes it can be very frustrating that, you know, what is it? And I like you saying it's historical fiction at a pinch. And I think, yeah, well, that's probably about right. But it's, I don't know, it wanted to be itself, you know, in the background of, as Edith begins to write her play, they're mounting a production of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, which of course is this, my God, I think there's more blood let in that play than maybe in all the rest of the, put together. But I was speaking just recently with the writer A.K. Blakemore, and she writes these amazing, strange, dark stories, novels, extraordinary, Manning Tree Riches and The Glutton, and there's more on the way. I can't wait. And she was saying, when we were having this wonderful discussion, we were saying, why don't you call us historical? Leave me alone. It's gothic. It's what interests me, And we were kind of also trying to get back to talking about folklore and talking about, what's underneath all the, get rid of the empire. What's underneath there? What else is there? What else is English, and actually getting lost in the folklore and things was really exciting. And that's, often necessarily kind of full of haunted figures. And East Anglia has its wonderful characters like Black Shook, which is that enormous black dog, sometimes just with one eye, sometimes with both. But if you see it, oh, that's a shame because you'll die. but those stories, one of the other things that I do as a teacher to the master students, I teach a class in fairy tales, and it's something I go back to again and again because these tales are primal. They tell us actually who we are as a human being, how to live, and they're cruel and strange and so exciting. Gave a big talk to my students on the juniper tree, which is part of the Grimm's collection, given to the Grimm's by a painter called Philip Otto Runge. But that fairy tale, which has the chant in it again and again, my mother, she killed me, my father, he ate me, is so thrilling. And actually, these tales use camouflage to tell very extraordinary truths about human beings, and we just get to the fact that they're very small and they're very bloody, and they actually tell us what human beings are. So I'm kind of always fascinated by those, and I don't care if I exaggerate, and I don't know necessarily where my books fit in. Would you call it historic? I don't know, historical, what would you call it? I don't know, whatever you call it. They're these books, they come out and you figure it out for yourself. I don't know. Why should I know? I wrote a kids trilogy about talking rubbish during Victorian times, among other things. And, sometimes it's published in countries as middle grade. Sometimes it's published as YA. Sometimes, and now more often, in particularly in Italy and France and Spain and places, it's just published as adult fiction. So I don't know. They seem to declare themselves as I'm working on them. But I'm fascinated by that world of childhood. Childhood literature that I got lost when I wrote my kids trilogy, or I had been. And actually, I was thinking of, to loop back, thinking of those books that I'd read in childhood that meant the most to me. And I wanted to get back to that loving of literature, why I loved it so much then. And I think I felt sort of hamstrung, and actually returning to that world of possibility of magic is made me love writing again. Made me love, the business of storytelling, and that, seemed to me so important that I need to be there whatever I'm writing. And I think there could be a mix between, stuff that's for children, stuff that isn't. Why do we have to? Sometimes, some of the greatest writing is children's fiction. Who reads Kipling if not for the Just So stories in the Jungle Book, not his adult work necessarily. And so sometimes this pigeonholing I can find frustrating, but I can't, but I can only write the books that I'm interested in writing. And some people go, but is this children's book? No. Maybe. I don't know. I don't wish to upset the children, but I don't know. They come out as they come out, and they need to be true for themselves. And this was a piece of theatre, so we're going to have, I'm afraid, corpses everywhere, and the exaggeration is huge here. But also Edith's narrating it, and we don't know whether to believe almost anything she says. And I didn't want to answer that problem. I want the reader to have their own opinions. if that makes sense.
Yeah, to me it does, yeah. I think I might have been scarred for life if I read this as a child, but but at the same time, maybe as a child I took these things more in my stride. I don't know. You can read Roald Dahl, you can read anything. We're coming up for an hour, so Rachel, maybe a final question from you?
Yeah, well, I would just love to know what's next, because, I mean, I love this and I feel like there's never enough Edward Carey. I've read everything, so what would you like? What's sort of percolating at the moment for you?
Something is, which is a really unhelpful answer.
Exclusive. Here we go.
Yeah, there you go. Something's coming along, I think. And then I've got something, other ideas sort of beyond that. I kind of got into a slightly frozen state again, and I think I'm coming out of it. I always, you know, when stuff is in the early stage, and there's something I always speak to my students about, I said, don't tell anybody about it. You have to keep it private. It's your own possession then, and you need to let it grow slowly of its own accord. And if you start talking about it too much, it will die before it get, you know, if it's not solid enough. And so you'll mention different bits, so, you know, and you could come back to me, Simon and Rachel, go, hang on, you said this new book was about such and such. It's got nothing to do with it. And you might be disappointed, and then I'd feel sad. So I think you have to keep it so close to yourself. I always go nuts when I see on ghastly Twitter, as it was now. It used to be amazing, but now it's just full of vomit, really. But, you know, people would go, hashtag am writing. And I would think, hashtag shut up. Actually, just keep quiet. Just do it for itself and be able to listen to it, to actually work out what it is that you're making. You know, and sometimes if I have, you know, if I'm teaching MFA students and they want to show your workshop, say, some of the novel, I would say, how much of a novel have you got? And if they go, well, I'll finish the first chapter by next Wednesday and I'll send it to you on Thursday. You go, are you out of your mind? Keep that to yourself. Let it, you know, now I'm married to a writer, Elizabeth McCracken, and we now are at a stage, and this didn't used to be the case, is we don't tell each other what we're working on until we've finished a whole draft of something. And, you know, each time we say, what are you doing? Piss off, leave me alone. And then finally we'll go, well, here we are. And that may be 3 years, you know, or more. You know, sometimes I have a novel about him too, so it took me 15 years to finish. But and then finally, when we're ready, we'll say, yeah, here's a first draft. And then you're ready to share it. But I think those books in their infancy need to be absolutely private. This is a very rude response to your very nice question.
Shut up, Rachel, is what I'm hearing. well, we will look forward to it, whatever it is. And we're so thankful that you came on the episode. It was so lovely to have you.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
I'm glad. For our listeners, in the next episode, Rachel and I will be discussing two Willa Cather novels, novellas, A Lost Lady and Sapphira and the Slave Girl. Thanks once again to our guest, Edward. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Edward.
Thank you so much.